if you're not good enough at ultrasound, that's not an excuse to punish your patients with radiation.
Get out there, ultrasound some hearts, some lungs, some IVCs. Let us know how you feel about it.
Yeah, we can definitely do that, or we could be better clinicians and use our ultrasound.
Hello, this is Jacob Avila of the Ultrasound Podcast. Now, previously, we heard from the emergency physicians, Dr. Reardon, Dr. Weimersheimer, in Vermont, where they kind of focus in on their practice. Now, who I want to talk to now is the cardiologist who actually saw the patient after the initial workup. Now, the cardiologist who took care of this case is Dr. Joel Wolkowitz. Now, Dr. Wolkowitz did medical school in Montreal, did his internal medicine training there, did his cardiology training there, and works currently in Plattsburgh. Now, Joel, question for you. We kind of have our thing as emergency physicians. We kind of have our way of diagnosing tamponade. As a cardiologist, how do cardiologists kind of as a field, how do they usually diagnose tamponade?
At this point, we rely on echo very heavily to make the diagnosis or to exclude the diagnosis. It's really our go-to tool at this time.
Okay. So is that what everybody does, yourself included?
Yeah, I would say, certainly greater than 95% of the time, that's what we do. You use the physical exam. Nowadays, it seems everybody in the emergency room ends up with a CT scan, so we have that as well. But really, to make the diagnosis, it's almost exclusively echo. Every once in a while, we'll actually take them to the cath lab for hemodynamics, but that's pretty unusual these days.
Okay. Now, what about going back before imaging? What about vital signs? I know when I was in medical school, they talked a lot about this whole Beck's triad and all this stuff with vital signs and physical exam. But the more I read, the more I see that patients apparently can have pretty severe tamponade and have normal vital signs. So maybe a little bit of an elevated heart rate, but less than 100, blood pressure, not really considered hypotensive from our point of view. What are your thoughts on vital signs physical exam for diagnosing tamponade?
Well, I completely agree with what you just said. Beck's triad dates back to the old days before we had imaging. And so tamponade, like so many other diagnoses these days, was only made in very advanced stages. And it's rare that patients are so sick or are so advanced in tamponade that you make it, that they have the findings of Beck's triad. So typically the patients, have some symptoms. Most commonly it's shortness of breath, or there may be some sensation of dyspnea, just being unwell. I find they're very commonly tachycardic. JVP is often up if you look for it. Of course, often these days, especially if the patient is sick, we move to imaging even before we kind of do a complete physical exam. Not that that's the way ideally it should be, but the JVP is commonly up. Pulsus paradoxus, is useful, but the truth is it's not done very frequently. But they're typically tachycardic. They may or may not be tachypneic. Blood pressure may be low if it's pretty advanced, but often the blood pressure is okay. So you can't rely on hypotension to make the diagnosis. Often just a sense of being unwell. So you know something is wrong, and usually it's with imaging that we're clued into the possible findings of tamponade.
Okay. No, that makes perfect sense. Now, as somebody who, I only know one way of fixing this, and that's basically trying to find the biggest pocket on ultrasound and then sticking a needle and draining it. From a cardiologist perspective, if you have a patient that is hemodynamically stable, you have time to take them up to a controlled environment, could you briefly tell us how you guys fix this? Because this is something that we might not actually know as far as what you guys do.
Yeah. Sure. So, no, you're right. There's really only one way to fix it, and that's drain fluid. You can give them oxygen. If they're hypotensive, sometimes you give them fluids, but really that doesn't treat anything, and you have to drain them. Ideally, I like to take them to the cath lab, and I do it with both echo and fluoroscopic guidance. I feel most comfortable doing it like that. I've done almost all the pericardiocentesis. I've probably done over 100 in my life, and I do the vast majority like that. But we use echo, as you said, to find the biggest pocket, and I look for where the pericardial fluid is closest to the surface. And most of the time, it's either periapical or subcostal. It's very unusual that it's going to be parasternal, but periapical or subcostal. So I do it. I image them again myself in the cath lab. I rarely image anymore, but this is the one time I'll take the probe from the sonographer, image myself. I kind of make a note to myself, not just where I'm have the probe, but the orientation of the probe to the surface, because my needle is going to follow that orientation exactly.
I see. And
then we prep the patient. We, you know, again, if it's not an absolute emergency, we do it in a sterile fashion. We prep the patient, try to sedate the patient a little bit, and then use that spot, a little lidocaine to the skin and subcutaneous tissue. And depending on how far the fluid is from the surface, I like to go in with just a larger gauge needle. Sometimes if it's close enough, you'll enter it just with your anesthetic needle, which is nice. Because then you know for sure where you are and you've only used a small gauge needle. But otherwise, I'll switch over to a larger gauge needle. And like I say, follow the same path and aspirate fluid. Typically, if it's subcostal, you'll need a larger needle, and I use the two-piece longer needle that comes with the pericardiocentesis kits that we use. That's a little trickier to use if you're not used to doing that, because you can't aspirate while you're advancing, at least not continuously. So you kind of have to you have to feel where you actually pop the pericardium. So that's a little trickier. But otherwise, the needle goes in, you aspirate, and then once you aspirate, you pass a wire, and this is where I use fluoroscopy, because I see where the wire goes under fluoroscopy. Most of the time, you'll see it stay within the pericardial space, and you know you're good. Occasionally, it'll go in the right ventricle and out the pulmonary artery, or into the pleural space, and so fluoroscopy tells you if you're outside the pericardial space, in which case, obviously, you need to withdraw and reorient. So for an ER doc, that's probably going to be tough, because you're not used to fluoroscopy, you're not used to the landmarks that a cardiologist is accustomed to. So I take advantage of fluoroscopy as well as echo. I use all the tools I have available to me, unless it's a real emergency, in which case I'll do it in the ER just under echo alone.
So what do you think, with this specific patient, what do you think the course would have been if they had not found this on ultrasound? Because, I mean, the initial complaint was just essentially dyspnea and an elevated heart rate, which could have been a lot of different things.
Right, right. You're absolutely right. I think we would have treated the supraventricular tachycardia. She probably would have gotten IV diltiazem. And she may have become hypotensive getting IV diltiazem under those circumstances. She may have tolerated very poorly. So the diagnosis probably wouldn't have been made until some imaging was done. I don't know what I would have done seeing the patient without knowing she was in tamponade, whether I would have, you know, gone through the steps I outlined at the beginning and actually made the diagnosis, or if it would have waited for an echo, which might have been done perhaps when she became hypotensive. But it's quite possible, getting to your point, that it would have taken hours, maybe even the next day, before we appreciated that tamponade was present.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I see. And when we catch these in the emergency department, that's what always we're worried about. I mean, you have an undifferentiated sort of sick patient. Without the ultrasound, I think it would take hours. And like you said, maybe even a day to actually get this diagnosis done. So a good plug for using it.
Yeah. And in this lady in particular, she had, you know, a history of atrial fibrillation. Mm-hmm. And so who would have been faulted for just treating the atrial fibrillation when she came in not feeling well? That would have been kind of the logical thing to do.
Yeah, no, agreed.
And the other thing, Dr. Reardon did the POCUS study. She didn't just find the fluid, which
I think all ER docs are able to do now. But she actually made the diagnosis for me. She told me by phone that the IVC was dilated and not collapsing. And she really deserves credit for that, because that clinched the diagnosis for me. So I knew before I left my house what was going on and what I had to do. And that was a first for me, having an ER doc give me that kind of information over the telephone.
Wow, awesome. That's a really good case, and I'm glad that things turned out well. Now, let's say that you are a cardiologist and there's something that you would like to tell emergency physicians, either to do better or to keep in mind. Do you have any advice for us as ER doctors that might take care of a sick cardiac patient? Not necessarily a tamponade patient, but just a cardiac patient from the point of view of a cardiologist.
Yeah, well, the first thing I would say is don't stop thinking when you get back a positive troponin.
Okay.
Positive troponin obviously could be an acute MI, but it could be many other things. And any sick patient for almost any reason can have a mild troponin elevation. And so you obviously have to consider myocardial infarction. But if there's another obvious or potential problem, be it heart failure or pneumonia or certainly sepsis, this is not the time to give them heparin and call cardiology and turn your brain off. You have to keep thinking. And that's the biggest problem that I see now is elevated troponin. Somebody wants to start heparin. Somebody wants to take them to the cath lab and everybody stops thinking.
Brilliant. Yeah, that's great advice. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. Dr. Wolkowitz, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy day. And hopefully we'll be able to send more good cases your way.
Yeah, my pleasure. Take care. Thank you.
Thank you. Very happy to have Dr. Wolkowitz on the podcast to talk about the diagnosis and management of a pericardial tamponade. I will leave you with this thought. Pericardial tamponade is not a clinical diagnosis. If you wait for your patient to be decompensated, be hypotensive, be crashing and dying, you are waiting entirely too long. If you have sonographic evidence of tamponade, that is a collapsing right ventricle in diastole, you have an IVC that is plump without any respirophasic variation, it doesn't really matter what the vital signs show. That patient has sonographic tamponade and you need to move quickly. Now, I know that the physical exam definitely has a place, but I definitely think that ultrasound is the more important in the two in the early diagnosis of tamponade. Now, if you want to listen to part one, head over to the website, that is coreultrasound.com. And if you want a refresher on how to perform a pericardiocentesis, or even taking a couple steps back, if you want to learn how to perform a ultrasound in general for just the diagnosis of pericardial effusion or the diagnosis of tamponade, there will be tutorials on the websites as well.